1202 here in the Fan, Susan Waldman and Howie Rosen. Let's go up to Fenway Park, where I'm trying to figure out how they possibly can be social distancing in that press box, and bring in our good friend Pete Abraham of the Boston Globe. Now, how are you doing this? I mean, that is the most put together press box. How are you distancing in that place?
Well, good morning, guys. What we're doing is they use some of the tables next to the press box on the left field side where normally fans would sit. And they have some people out there, and we have, I would say, at least a third of the spots in the press box are marked off that we can't use. And so people are able to sit 6 feet apart. There's only maybe 10 of us who are coming on a daily basis. And we're pretty much not very close to each other. So it's working out so far. I don't know how it's going to be during the season, but I also don't think there's going to be a whole lot of media that's going to travel with their teams, too, during the season.
No, I wouldn't think so. A couple of things. One, I got a look yesterday at Mitch Moreland sitting outside what is now his locker. I guess the suites at Fenway Park have been turned into lockers all the way around the park?
Yeah, they did kind of a neat thing. As you know, Susan, you've been in here before. There's not much room in the Fenway Park clubhouse, even in good times. And so what they did in trying to find a way to social distance the players and use more space, they took all the suites on the right field side and turned them into basically two-man locker rooms. So those suites are actually pretty well appointed. They're fairly new at Fenway, and they have bathrooms, and there's a lot of space, and there's like a sort of like a porch out in the front that overlooks the park with a few seats. So there's two guys in each one of those, and they've staggered, usually it's players that play different positions. So one group is coming in at a certain time, another group doesn't come in for like 2.5 hours later. So there's only, I guess, once in a while are they in the same room together. So the play, it's really funny. As we talk to the players, that's the first thing they bring up is how much they like these new suites.
And I'll bet they do.
Yeah, and J.D. Martinez made a crack that, even next year, if everything's back to normal, he's gonna try to convince them to make those the locker rooms, but I don't think that's going to happen. But it's, they have to come up with something because there's not much room here.
It's interesting that you say when we talk to the players, because that's what it's become. It's a group interview, and it's done via Zoom, and so everybody has access to the same questions and the same answers. And generally speaking, we get, as broadcasters, ready for a game. There are certain individuals that we'll try to talk to privately or at least one-on-one because we're looking for certain angles or information we can use. You guys desperately need to be able to have sources and one-on-one interviews so that you could pursue individual angles to your columns and your game stories. How compromised do you feel as a journalist not having the kind of access that you usually do?
Well, to this point, Howie, I would say not as much as I thought, because it's been good just to be able to write about baseball again. And we spent a good part of 3 months just really trying to come up with, historical stories and personal reflections and everything kind of other than writing about what was going on with the team because everybody was home. So it's been, at least from my standpoint, it's been okay to be able to talk to the pitcher, even if it's with everybody else or the manager or whoever it may be, because you're at least able to ask questions and write something off of those questions and talk about what they did. I think the fans have a lot of interest in our readers about what they're doing at Fenway and how they're preparing for the season and what they think about coming back. So that's all so far been pretty good. I think as we get going, it's going to be a delicate balance between that and asking the PR staff to, can you arrange a phone call with me with somebody? I need to ask them a few questions I don't want to ask in front of everybody else. Or whether it's text messaging people, there's going to be different ways we're going to have to do it.
Right.
I think for people who write columns, it's going to be really difficult.
I'm sorry. Do you have concerns that as teams learn to live with these restrictions that were not in place before, that they may become a little more permanent than we'd like?
Yeah, that's something the BBWA has been talking a lot about, that we need to be vigilant in the idea that this isn't going to be something they're going to say, it worked out fine last year, let's just keep doing it. And I think we have allies in that sense in the commissioner's office, that they realize that it's good for the game to have people covering it and talking to the players individually. And the best stories really come out of individual access. You don't really get great stories when there's 20 people around. But you get some really good stories, and the most memorable stories are when you get good access to a player and you talk to him one-on-one. And I believe the commissioner's office is on our side with that. I'm not so sure about the Players Association. So hopefully when the CBA is negotiated, there's not some, you know, something where the, we just lose all of our access. I think that would be, I mean, it would be bad for us, but we'd figure out a way. But it would be, I think it would be really bad for people who read our stories that they wouldn't have as much knowledge about whether it's the Yankees or the Red Sox, whoever it may be.
I think to just go on that before I ask you about the team and what you think of the realignment that we've got going on here, one of the things that I think the players think is that with their own social media accounts, Twitter and whatever, Instagram, et cetera, that they can put out what they want. And that actually, I think that's a detriment to fans in a way, because fans do think they see them more personally on their own Instagram, but it's through there, the stories that get out are what they want to get out, and not always is that better for the fans. And I think you just, you know, it's better to have somebody else do something with a player than have a player talk about himself. I really think that, and I'm not quite sure the players think that, but we'll see how that goes. Now, looking at the Red Sox and how they're going to go in this new aligned thing, you got a starter problem at the moment, yes?
Big time, yeah. I mean, they traded David Price, and then Rick Porcello left as a free agent, went to the Mets. Chris Sale blew out his arm and had Tommy John surgery in spring training. So Eduardo Rodriguez, who they felt all along was going to be one of their best pitchers, has probably gone from the number three to the number one, and then he tested positive on the intake testing, so we haven't seen him yet. So now you're looking at Nate Eovaldi as their number one starter, and Martin Perez, who they signed to be their number five starter, he's their number two starter. And we really don't know what's going to happen with three, four, and five. There's a lot of guys who potentially could do it. There's not a lot of guys with experience. There's not a lot of guys who've had success as starters. I don't know that anybody, I mean, it's hard to imagine making a trade. How do you make a trade in the middle of a pandemic and send somebody from one environment to another? And that seems really problematic. But if they have any designs on competing, they are going to need to figure out something to do, you know, whether they can only use an opener so many times. You can't use it three times through a rotation. So I don't know what they're going to do with their rotation.
You know, you talked about trades. Consider this possibility right now. And I came up from Florida a few days ago, so I've got a quarantine, right? Now, I know that there have been different protocols for the players, given that they are in the proper tiers of MLB's safety and health protocol program. But let's say this spike in Florida, hypothetically, it's not hypothetical in Florida, but a couple of months from now, a month from now, Florida's still got a huge number of cases, and Governor Cuomo here in New York mandates a quarantine. If a player is dealt from, say, the Miami Marlins to the New York Mets or the New York Yankees, will that player have to quarantine for 2 weeks based on the governor's mandate? That's got to be taken into consideration too, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. And my understanding is that the players would be allowed to join teams, because that would be true. Let's say the Mets played at the Marlins and then were playing the next day in Philadelphia, whatever it may be. You know, there would have to be some sort of quarantine, but there won't be. You know, you're not going to quarantine the whole team for 2 weeks. So I think the players, because they're being tested every other day, would be allowed to join their teams. But we did some checking because we were trying to figure out how many road games we were going to cover. If the Red Sox go to Tampa and I cover that series, I can't go to Fenway Park for 2 weeks. So we're going to have to be very careful whether we go at all. We're going to have to be careful about who we send on the road and where we send them. And we don't think we can go to Toronto, for instance, because the Ontario government is very firm about not allowing Americans in without a quarantine. So we're not going to send somebody to Toronto for 14 days so they can cover three games. So there's going to be a lot of
maybe you'll
things.
Go to Buffalo from the sound of things.
Well, who knows, right? But it's really becoming, you know, just for us trying to figure out logistically what we want to do. It's something we have a meeting about almost every day.
You know, when you look at this and, you know, you were joking, I saw the other day, about next year when the schedule came out. Do you have any idea why that schedule for next year came out? I was looking for, you know, when you talked about which day is going to be Mookie Betts's return bobblehead day at Fenway Park. Do you have any idea why they decided to put out the 2021 schedule? It just, you know, just hit me. Figured
in fact,
maybe
in fact, I do, Susan. I made a few calls and asked.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. So obviously there seems like there's very little chance there's going to be fans at games this year. So teams that have season ticket holders and people who bought tickets, they're now in the process of refunding those tickets or trying to figure out what to do. My understanding is all of the teams, most of the teams anyway, contacted MLB and said, if you put out the schedule for next year now, we can better negotiate with people who have tickets. and say to them, you know, yes, you can't have a refund. We're legally obligated to give you a refund. But hey, look, you know, here's the schedule for next year. Maybe you can just, you know, hold, well, you know, well, essentially the teams are trying to hold on to your money and then give you the tickets for next year. So that's where it came from, was teams wanting to have something that they could sell to the fans for next year.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, when you consider that the American League East is going to play the National League East and vice versa, the crossovers for all the divisional and interleague play this year is going to put a little bit different wrinkle into this thing. What kind of a factor do you think that'll be in trying to figure out who's supposed to wind up doing what as far as surviving this pennant race?
Yeah, I think it's got a lot to do with it because it's not going to be balanced. You look at who the teams are playing, and if you're playing the Mets and the Braves and the Nationals, you have it a lot harder certainly than if you're playing the Marlins and the Phillies. So when you look at the schedules, it appears that the Red Sox had a tougher interleague schedule than the Yankees. The Rays and the Yankees are pretty close. So that, I think, is clearly going to affect the American League East. And I'm sure with the National League East teams, you'd probably prefer not to play the Rays and the Yankees if you can help it because of their pitching. So I think I think the interleague games are going to have a lot to say about both divisions in terms of who ends up in the playoffs. And I know the Red Sox close with the Nationals, I think it is, and that's going to be a difficult process for them. So.
You know, it's interesting, and you bring that up, and I was thinking about that too. That's going to be difficult. I know it's less games, but you know, Philly's going to have a good team, and Washington obviously has a good team. The Braves are going to have a good team. Now, here's my choice here. I am fascinated with, and always have been, about what Tampa Bay does all the time. Now they've lost all kinds of people, and Chaim Bloom is now in Boston, and Andrew Friedman has been in the Dodgers, but they always seem to come up with a way to do things, and it happens fast out of the gate. And you know, the saying, boys play early, men play late, because baseball is a game of attrition. I would wonder about the Tampa Bay Rays. Can they get off to such a good start with what they're doing that they can hold on while the other teams kind of change up? Because they always find pitching, always.
Yeah, they're an interesting team because they, you know, everybody was talking about them using the openers, but now they have a pitching staff where they might not need an opener. Well, you know, they have Charlie Morton and Glasnow and Snell and all of these guys that they can bring out there. And their bullpen, I mean, I'm sure you've seen this plenty of times, Susan. They bring in these guys in the seventh and eighth inning who are throwing the heck out of the ball, and you're like, who's this guy? And when Chaim Bloom got to the Red Sox, one of the things that they talked about was they wanted somebody who would look for those kind of pitchers, that find these guys that maybe didn't succeed with another team, but there's something about them that you like, and if you put them in certain situations, they can dominate. And the Red Sox have signed a whole bunch of pitchers who have very little experience and very little success. And I think their hope is that you take these 15 guys and you see what they have, and you might find four of them who are pretty damn good. And that's what they're hoping is going to happen with Chaim Bloom, that instead of just going out and making the most obvious move and spending the most money, you can work the edges and try to find some of these guys, and next thing you know, you have a lights-out guy for the seventh inning, and that helps you win a series.
Are you assuming, as many people seem to be, that Ron Renicke is a caretaker?
Yeah, I think so, Howie. When, you know, this all came together so quickly because Alex Cora was essentially forced out in January. Spring training's coming up fast, and it was going to be difficult, I think, anyway, to bring in somebody from the outside because this team was so close to Cora and so identified with Cora. Renicke had their trust. He had been the bench coach for 2 years. They all knew him. He knew them. And then when the pandemic hit, I think that made it, you know, really necessary to have a guy like Ron Renicke around. And I really feel for him because he's a baseball lifer. He's a really good guy. He wanted to manage again. And here he is taking over this team with a new GM, with Alex Cora gone, with Chris Sale blowing out his elbow, with Mookie Betts being traded, and now they're in the middle of this pandemic. And this is certainly not what he signed up for. But I think he's doing it. You know, in the players that we've spoken to, and I've texted back and forth with a few guys, they've all been really happy about the way Ron has kind of kept everybody together during this whole thing. And they feel like, I think unanimously, that he's the best guy to have in that chair right now. Now, I don't know if that's going to be a long-term thing. He's going to be 64. I'm sure Chaim Bloom's going to want his own guy at some point. He probably has that person in mind already. But I think for now, he's probably the best guy to try to get them through this season.
Now, is there a chance that, I know that Chaim Bloom wasn't there when he was there, but is there a chance that Alex Cora comes back?
Well, he's going to be able to be employed once the World Series is over, so I would think that there is a chance. It's every time we've asked Ty and Bloom about it, he said, well, there were reasons that he's no longer the manager, that, you know, they looked at what he did in Houston. They didn't find that acceptable. Everybody agreed that he had to go, and that hasn't changed. He got off in the investigation into the Red Sox. There was nothing that was found against him in that. That's on his side. But I guess there's two things in play. One would be whether Alex wants to come back or whether he wants to do something else in baseball. And B, if the Red Sox ownership says, hey, we want Alex Cora back, you know, Chaim Bloom's not going to have much to say about it. So I think that's going to be the biggest thing, is if the Red Sox owners, and they talked about him like he was part of the family when they had to let him go. I mean, that was a very emotional press conference for them. If they decide, hey, the best way we can get this team back to where we want is to bring Alex Cora back, I don't think Chaim Bloom's going to have much to say about that. But at the same time, how do you hire somebody to be, I'm trying to remember what they call it, the chief baseball officer? You make somebody the chief baseball officer, you would think that guy would get the right to hire the manager.
So who gets hired first somewhere, whether it's with the Red Sox or not, A.J. Hinch or Alex Cora?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because both of those guys are really prototypical modern managers. They communicate really well with their teams. They're steeped in analytics. They've both been successful in one World Series. I think that, you know, if you're a person who's trying to get your team going, I don't see how you could do much better than either one of those guys. And certainly, I think A.J., in that interview we did with MLB Network, you know, showed a lot of contrition. Alex Cora hasn't done one of those yet, but I suspect he probably will. And I think when you look at, it's sort of strange, but in a way, I think the pandemic helps both of those guys, because it's hard to get fired up about sign stealing, given everything that's happened in the country in the last 10 months. So if somebody's going to be like, oh, I can't believe you hired a manager who was involved in sign stealing, I mean, that's not as big a deal as it might have been without everything else that's happened.
Yeah, and the luckiest team in all of baseball is the Houston Astros, there will be no fans. So, you know, by the time, you know, next year, are they going to start again? I don't know. You know, do you hold something out like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are going to be people who are going to give them a hard time, and people are going to be people, but it's hard.
Not like this year.
Yeah, but how do you get, I mean, it's really hard to get, to muster up much indignation about sign stealing, you know, giving everything else that's gone on. How do you get fired up about that?
I got a quick question for you, too, also. I was watching, I saw some pictures, they were going around the league on MLB. Look, this is what my life has turned out to. I'm watching people do batting practice on inter-squad games on MLB or on YES. And there's Jason Varitek, who, tell him to mix in a salad, will he? There's Jason Varitek in an umpire's unit. He was having much too much fun umpiring that game.
Well, you know, they wanted to get somebody behind the plate to make it a little more game-like, and so they asked Varitek if he would do it. He wanted to do it, and Tommy McLaughlin, the clubhouse manager, called somebody and got an umpire's uniform, the whole, you know, the gray pants and the black shoes and the blue shirt, the whole thing, the little cap, the whole business, and Tech was behind the plate, and the funny part was in the first inning, J.D. Martinez struck out looking, and he really punched him out. It was a very elaborate signal to punch him out. And J.D. kind of turned around on his way back to the dugout, like, what are you doing? And the next time somebody struck out, it was a little less, enthusiastic. So it was for people in Boston, they got a big kick out of it.
That's
and
great.
Our paper ran a bunch of photos of it. And, it was kind of a neat thing. And Varitek's going to be, he's not an official member of the coaching staff, but he is going to be, you know, part of the mix for a lot of the games this season.
We're talking to Pete Abraham at 11:21, Howie Rose, Susan Waldman with you on The Fan. And I get the feeling, or at least I'm starting to, Pete, and a caller brought this up an hour or two ago, that as I am very much in favor of the 3-batter minimum rule for an incoming pitcher, that I might be the only guy in the country, never mind connected with Major League Baseball, who actually feels that way. Every manager I've spoken to, present or former, hates it. Have you come across anyone who can have my back on this and support it?
You know, I have not, and I tried to do that story during spring training, and most of the people I talked to think that it was an overreach because there aren't that many one batter specialists anymore. There used to be a lot of lefties who would come in and get one hitter and that was it. And I think managers have gotten away from that. And whether it's analytics and figuring out right-handers that can handle lefties or different, I think it's roster management too. It's hard to carry one guy who can only face one hitter a game. And I think teams have gotten away from that. So it would have been probably a great rule 5 years ago, But I'm not so sure it's going to have the effect that they think it's going to have in terms of shortening the game. To me, and I've had a couple of managers tell me this, they think this is going to be a one and done, that they're going to realize it's not making much of an impact, and they'll move off it next year and try to figure out something else. And to me, overall, they're trying to control the pace of play 5 seconds and 10 seconds at a time. And they need to find something that's going to take a big chunk out of it. Instead of putting together 17 rules that take out 10 seconds, they got to figure out one way that can take out 5 minutes. And
I got the answer. I'm telling you, I've got a foolproof way to do it, but it would never happen because if there is money to be made, everybody's going to grab as much as they can. Consider that the technology is there, and we see it certainly during postseason games. We've seen it in other sports where on television, they'll split the screen and you'll see a live feed. And in baseball, it's perfect because they do it between batters. You'll see the live feed on one side of the screen, and for 10, 15, or 20 seconds, they'll show a sponsorship on the other side. Well, that's extra revenue, right? Now, if you cut 1 minute off of every between innings break, every half inning, consider the amount of time you would save over a 9-inning game or an 8.5-inning game, and that revenue that you lose hypothetically could be replaced by what you gain from rolling in all of these 15 and 20 second split screen spots. But with the technology there to do that and the knowledge that, hey, not only can we compensate for the revenue we would lose, we could have it all. Well, which faction do you think is going to win? The have it all group or the ones who are more loyal to speeding things up a little bit and replacing one source of revenue with another?
Well, yeah, but you get to exactly what I was talking about, Howie, that there needs to be, I think they should do one thing that cuts it down significantly instead of trying to come up with all of these ticky-tack rules that'll save a couple seconds.
Yeah, but that would do it right there.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it would be a good idea. Yeah, I think this whole, we're going to cut down on one pitching change a game, that'll really help. I don't think that's going to help at all.
I don't think it's going to help either, because if there's a lefty that they want to keep in there, they'll just walk the next guy. And that's another. The other thing is they could do, have you noticed, and I know in the last 20 years it's gotten more, but I mean even more, most batters now, I won't say all of them, they will not start walking to the plate until their walk-up music starts.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I spent all last year looking and writing down. I mean, I know it's a minute, 2 minutes, and then they walk to the beat of it very, very slowly. How about doing what you used to do? Get in the batter's box and hit. I mean, what a concept.
I think a lot of this goes back to, and I think about covering Al Leiter when I covered the Mets, and Al was a big advocate of sports psychology and having conviction in the pitch. You got to have conviction in the pitch. And he would talk about how he didn't want to throw a pitch until he was, really sure that was the right pitch to throw. And I think at some point it went from the pitcher has an advantage if he works quickly to pitchers thinking that they have an advantage if they take their time and really think about what they want to do and have this conviction in their pitch. And I think a lot of that is it causes hitters to be slower. It causes pitchers to be slower. There's a lot of, visualize what you're going to do next. And they think about this stuff and they have their routine. And I think part of it is, I think a team that would tell their pitchers, you're going to benefit if you work faster, and then other teams copy that, that would really help the game too, because there is something to be said, I think, for a pitcher to work quicker and keep the hitter off balance than to stand out there like David Price does and wait 20 seconds before you pitch, because you need to be convinced that, this is a good time to throw a slider. And that, I think, has changed the game a lot in the last 10 or 15 years.
Any of these rules changes or experiments that you like?
Well, you're probably not going to like this, Howie, but I'm okay with the universal DH. I think that.
I've come around on that.
Oh, okay.
Around on that. I think it's a necessity.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, the National League, I think, was one of like two leagues in the entire world that was still using a DH. So, I think that's okay. And the rest of it, I don't think it's going to make much of a difference. I think it's okay to use the extra innings rule during this season, but I hope they don't do it permanently. I think that would be a shame. But I think it's okay for this season.
I have two questions for you. One, is it even silly to go through projections or predictions because you don't know who's going to be sick in 5 minutes or 10 minutes? And two, are you the only writer ever who's covered all three teams, the Mets, the Yankees, and the Red Sox?
Well, let me answer the first question. J.D. Martinez had a great answer to that the other day. He said the team that stays the healthiest is probably going to be the team that wins it. And the team that does the best job of all of their guys sticking together and not going out when they're not supposed to and doing all the things they're supposed to do, they might not be the most talented team. But the team that has their most good players available at the right times is probably going to be the team that wins. And how do you predict that? And I think, Susan, that I'm the only one who's done that. I know Steve Buckley covered the Red Sox and Yankees, but I don't think he covered the Mets. So
I don't think he did either.
Yeah, there must be. There's probably somebody who must have done it at some point, but I don't know. I'm the only one who did it with Howie Rose and Susan Holman on the radio. Those Mets and Yankees, I know that.
That's right.
Sorry.
Can't
all right, help so what, you there.
So what's up with Red Sox inter-squad games today? Who's pitching and who's playing? Who's playing right field?
Alex Verdugo is going to play right field. He's available. Yeah, actually, he's going to be a good player. He's probably going to be one of their better hitters, I think. He's a good-looking player. Today we have the beginner squad game, and Brian Johnson, who was designated for assignment in November and could be the number three starter, is going to be on the mound.
So. Gee. What a time for poor Chaim Bloom to come over. This wasn't what he expected, was it?
You know, I feel he's a really good guy, and I've gotten to know him a little bit, and we've had some nice conversations. His family, his wife's a lawyer, and he's got two kids. They have a nice home. They had a nice home in St. Petersburg, and he was going to wait and move at some point because he wanted his kids to finish the school year, and then he was going to move up to Boston permanently. He was telling me about the challenges of trying to move from Florida to Boston in the middle of all of this, and I talk about, I mean, that I think was more complicated than trying to put together a baseball team. So I really feel for him. He's a good guy who's been in a tough spot for a long time now.
Well, there are a lot of complications, perhaps some of which are even at this stage unforeseen, that we'll learn about in the weeks and hopefully 2-3 months to come. What's your quick prediction? Are we going to get this thing done uninterrupted July 23rd right through the end of the regular season on September 27th and hopefully to the World Series?
Boy, I mean, I think, you know, I'm optimistic that they're going to get the season started. It seems like all the teams are doing what they're supposed to do. After that, I don't know. I think a lot of things are going to change once teams leave their ballparks and have to start going on the road. Then you need to start, you're going to have more crowded conditions and clubhouses on the road. You're going to have to trust players when they go on the road to stay in the hotels. You're going to have plane flights. You're going to have bus rides. So all of these things that they're not doing now. If they get through the first 2 weeks of testing and there's not a big spike, I think that'll give them a chance. But I think those first 2 weeks are going to be very indicative of whether we're going to be able to get this done.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it'll be even after that because guys will be really good for a while. But, you know, like I just read this morning about the Blue Jays putting a fine in if you leave the whole Sky Dome area. It's not Sky Dome anymore. Rogers Center. They're all going to live at that hotel, I mean, and go back and forth from the
right.
And not go out. I mean, how long can that last? And then what happens when teams start coming in there? I think this is complicated at best. I don't blame them for trying, but I don't know. I kind of have my doubts here. That's all.
I also wonder what's going to happen if a team is a bad team and it's September 1st and you're already, you know, you're 10 games out and you have no chance. How good is that team going to be about following all the rules? And that's probably what's going to turn the whole thing is, if it's one team, you might be able to get away with it. But if two or three teams break down and 15 guys test positive, then I think the commissioner's not going to have much of a choice but to cancel the season at that point.
Well, Pete, I know we're going to I'll be talking to you at some point. I guess we won't be able to do our little pregame interviews like we do every year in person. Maybe we'll do them over the phone or Zoom or something like that.
How are you at Zooming, Susan? Are you good at Zooming?
I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
I heard that you can make your own background, which I don't know how to do.
I did that. I have my lake as a background. I have me and the dogs as a background. The Yankee. I got somebody sent me the Yankee background. I have that on there. Yeah. We'll go on Zoom and I'll show you how to do it.
Oh, you're showing me up on the Zoom, Susan. Thanks a lot. Yeah, I appreciate that.
All right, Pete, thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Great talking to you, Pete.
It was very nice to talk to both of you guys. Thank you.
Pete Abraham, thanks. The Boston Globe. And I guess we got to take a break, right, Pete? Because I'm a minute late. I'm really sorry. Howie Rose, Susan Waldman here on The Fan. We'll be back.